ExoSkin, Scott, because when it really matters, and it does because it's your skin, you put on ExoSkin.
Take that variable out of your race. We have Erin Sagaski on the line right now, and she did something amazing. She ran a race called HOTS, Heat of the South. Erin, welcome. What is Heat of the South?
Started in West Memphis, Arkansas, and went through 5 states, ending at Castle Rock, Georgia.
How many miles is that, Erin?
340 miles, and you get a 10 days to do the race. It took me 9 days and 16 hours and some minutes to complete that race.
Boy, you need to make sure that you're protected. And you're a fan of ExoSkin. What gear were you using?
I wore the toe socks and the mid compression shorts during this journey. I alternated between 2 pairs of the mid compression shorts. And as you can imagine, over almost 10 days, everything was just dirty and it was hot and there was high humidity and lots of sweat. The most amazing thing about those shorts is there was not a single bit of chafing, not anywhere.
And also they
didn't even smell bad, really. I mean, we smelled pretty bad after that amount of time, and those shorts didn't smell bad at all.
They were the only thing in the gear bag that smelled good.
Basically, yeah, because nothing else did, for sure. The socks are also pretty amazing. You know, they keep your toes blister-free and keep your feet cool or warm, depending on the weather, really.
That's great. Well, we appreciate you coming on and giving us a little bit of a tip on how to take chafage and blistering out of the equation with ExoSkin. If you want to know more, you can go to ExoSkin's website, or you can go to our website, trailrunnernation.com, click on the partners page, and click on their banner. There's a discount there,
all
too.
Right. We ready? Yeah.
Yeah, thank you, Don. You know, I mean, I didn't know what it was going to be like. You know, you sound like a nice guy on this podcast, but...
But I know it's on the upper edge, and you guys have won a couple of awards, and...
You're recording this, aren't you, Freeman?
I get everything. All right, we ready?
Yeah.
We're excited to be working on the new TrailRunnerNation.com website. It'll be released and launched in about 3 weeks, but we need your help. We need some good trail candy, some good trail running photos. If you have a good one, or 2 or 3, why don't you email those to photos@trailrunnernation.com. That's photos@trailrunnernation.com. And we will select the best ones and sprinkle them throughout the website.
Welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation. My name is Don Freeman.
And I'm Scott Warr. And this is like herding cats. I'm in a sweat right now just getting this podcast going.
Well, Scott, you've created a new paradigm for us. We're doing something completely different, but our guests are consistent. And we have on the line here AJW, we have Brian Kontosh, and we have Terry Fletcher. And these are names, as you know, that were on the 100-mile challenge, the True Form Runner Challenge. And AJW wasn't on the trail, but he was in spirit, because as I look back through the texts, man, there were a lot of darts thrown our way, gentlemen. I'm glad we didn't have reception.
Yeah, you're glad you didn't get any of those texts from Andy while you were running.
So I think we'll get these guys to say hi in just a second, but I really want to set the precedence that we don't do activities and report them so people can hear about us. I mean, who does that? You know, people go and they watch vacation slideshows. Here's where we were when we had this meal, and here's a climb that we did. We're really going to talk about why others might want to do this, why they might be inspired to create their own adventure, because that's what we learned. It was a lot of fun. So first up, Brian.
Hang on, it just reminded me of a saying that my buddy that I grew up in Wyoming used to say. He says, the definition of heaven and hell, heaven is looking at old family photos, hell is looking at someone else's.
Good.
So we're not going to do that. We're going to hopefully have a good banter discussion. This is about the True Form Challenge, which took place when, Don?
July 20th.
July 20th.
Just a week ago.
Just this last Monday. And they started at 5:30-ish a.m.
We'll take that.
And which was pretty early, because some of these runners didn't get to bed until about 4:30 a.m., I think, Tosh.
and really didn't get on board until about 5:30 the next day, when he really got strong. We could see that 24 hours did him well out there on the trail. Hey, Brian, say hello.
Hey, everybody. How are you?
We also have Terry Fletcher, who was our young gun out there, 28 years old. And boy, if we were ever reminded that maybe, Tosh, you and I have creeped up a few years from 28, it was watching young Terry Fletcher out there just blazing the trail. How strong that guy is.
He's a machine. He really is a machine. I'm so impressed, man.
Yeah.
And if you go back to 2 weeks ago when we did the pre-podcast, it was kind of interesting how each of these three runners or these challengers prepared for the race. And what I came away with is Terry was just like, I'll go run 100 miles. Yeah, I can do that on a whim.
Well, one thing is we all had about the same amount of prep time. You know, we had about 8 weeks to get ourselves ready, you know, for whatever shape that we had let ourselves go into. And so there was that equivalency of preparedness, which made it so that we had to execute this thing very wisely. Now, AJW, from your standpoint, as a spectator at this point, what was your initial thoughts about this project and about how we executed?
Well, was it hard to climb over the fence at the end?
We're not going to talk about that, but there was no fence climbing involved.
All right. You know, I can say is as an outsider looking in, it must have been really, really hot and really, really snowy.
It may have been
50% accurate.
You have run this 10 times before in the past, all within the prescribed time, usually ending with silver, and probably all of them, and one time in 2005, which anybody that's been around you for at least 10 minutes has heard about 2005, and you, where you came in second place, had it not been for some Scott Jurek that showed up, you would have had a cougar in your studio right now where you're at. You've been a very, very strong runner. You know, it takes quite a bit of perseverance to do this thing in the period of time that we did. I'm not sure you would handle that.
No, and you guys, I mean, you guys did something I've never done before. You finished during the daylight. I mean, that's pretty impressive, you know, I was lucky most years to get to Highway 49 in the daylight. So kudos to you.
We saw the sunrise twice.
We enjoyed the course for 18 hours longer than you normally do. Also.
Hey, I want to get into a little bit of a description of the course for people that don't know the course. But before that, I want to go round robin here and get everybody's take on this question, including yours, Andy. When you finish a challenge or a race like this, do you find a quiet time where you finally have your wits about you? And do you analyze what you could have done better? Or do you look at the things that you learned?
I did that at mile 45. I have to wait to the end. What could I have done better? Go ahead, you guys. I'll
How about you, Terry? How do you deconstruct a race? Do you go through with a fine-tooth comb and say, you know what, I should have taken a little more salt tablets here. I should have put on a piece of duct tape on that blister there.
Normally, yeah, you do something like that, but I haven't really had the time to sit back and decompress and think about this one. I think for all of us, this was more of a adventure and less of a race. I wasn't too concerned about those little things in this one. It was more about the overall experience. Looking back on this one, my biggest takeaways were not of our own performances. It was of the performances of everyone else involved in this, everyone that helped put this together and helped make this thing a success. Just the selflessness and sacrifices that all those other people made. Don, your girlfriend Michelle, the whole Vernon family, and Emily, everything that they did to put this thing together and make it a success was really cool to see, and it was really humbling. So that was really my biggest takeaway. Less about our performances and more of the other stuff.
Boy, Tosh, if you say anything now, you're screwed. You can't top that. No,
I'm just going to say, I double up on everything that Terry said right there, you know, for sure.
Yeah,
thinking the same way.
But what about a normal race, Tosh? I mean, do you go through and deconstruct like you did when you were in the service where you went on a mission and you came back and said, okay, this is what we could have done better?
Absolutely. You know, normal events, not that this, like, what is normal anyways, but like other events that were, you know, prescribed, or you're registering for a bib or something like that, for sure. And really tackling those wave top items, and then a couple of the smaller internal processes that only you probably are aware of, that nobody else is. You know, we're internalizing a lot of things. But for what was so unique about this one was, it was just, we were just out there. You know, the goal going in was never about that. It was about the experiencing everything. So I feel like the onus on the backside isn't as high. There's no pressure there, because I don't really feel that I needed to analyze what I did, because what we were going there to do was just be together and absorb some beautiful scenery and some companionship. And we did exactly that. So in essence, really, there's no shortcomings to analyze, and only those highlights that Terry talked about, to just really just bask in appreciation for, and just count the blessings that we were surrounded with such amazing people.
Yeah, we started early deciding we're going to be together as a team. And, you know, our slowest guy was going to be our pace at that point. And we all shared in some of that slowness at times, except for Terry. And the one thing that I learned, I have some takeaways, and I really encourage others to assemble a team like this. You know, put together a core group of runners and a core group of supporters, and go out and reproduce this, because it, you know, I have a number of bib races that I've done, but I've got to say this stands out in the, you know, one of the very top adventures or runs that I've done, because the just the takeaways, the experience, the pride at the finish, and moving together as a unit, so cool. And here's one of the things that I thought was just a lot of fun. If we were climbing a hill, for instance, and it was getting warm, you know, it was warm for all of us, and somebody called for, you know, a pause. You know, give me two, guys. I need two here. And there was always someone that would come in behind and go, hey, I'm glad you called that pause, because I was ready too. Regardless if they were ready or not, there was just total support to one another. Like, hey, thanks for that call. Now, the guy that called the pause also called the start. So, you know, it wasn't like, hey, are you ready yet? Because then you feel like you're, you know, pulling someone through, or you feel like maybe you're holding the group up. But if you call the pause, you call the start. And I really just think that kind of unity, moving all the way through that same theme, whether it was stop for water, stop for a rock in the shoes, stop for a little heat break, was practiced, and practiced well, because there really wasn't any low spots that I can think of, because we managed properly. And part of our background together is we've all run the 200s together. That's how we met. And we spent a lot of time out there on the trails, qualifying one another, watching and learning from one another. And we get to practice a lot of those skills on this adventure. And I really like the camaraderie and the teamwork and the one for all, the three musketeers as we went through.
Yeah, that was awesome. That was it was sort of by design, but really we just kind of fell into our rhythm and we just responded to how things were working, and it was less about a prescription forethought than it was just like, oh, hey, this is working really well, and let's just respond to that. And I think it was super special that way. That was a highlight for me, just the way that we worked together.
And Jeff Vernon, who is one of the owners of Trueform Runner, who helped put this thing on, was commenting to me at the end of the race that traveling as a group of individuals instead of individuals slows the whole pack down, because if one person does have that, hey, I need to stop underneath the shade of this tree for a few minutes, the whole group stops. If someone needs to take a bio break, the whole group stops. If someone needs a little bit more time at an aid station, the whole group stops. So it's not, traveling as a group is not the sum of each individual. It's a different dynamic. And it was fun to watch.
You know, Terry, I'll throw this out to you, and I'm interested in your comments. Tosh is a natural leader. I felt like he was a silent leader. He led from behind. You know, we said, hey, Tosh, you know, come on up front during this point. And he goes, I got you. I'm just back here. I'm just leading from behind. And I think a lot of these things that we're taking credit for, so these procedures and techniques were really just given to us, and he helped set the pace for that.
Was that planned, Tosh? this nonverbal leadership? Did you play in Jedi mind tricks with the other two?
Three-dimensional chess.
Yeah.
No. I accept that, Don, and I appreciate that. And I think you're being very generous, though, also with the compliments. I'm writing something right now called Leadership from the Back of the Bus. You know, different concept on leadership. Everybody thinks leadership, you got to be out on the front and leading by example. And sometimes leading is really just setting conditions or sitting in the back and watching how everything's unfolding and kind of either aligning resources or preventing buffers and encouraging certain directions so that the people in front that are executing can explore. I would say, yeah, there were certain times during the course that I was thinking along those lines, and then just some of it's just naturally how I like to work. But man, Tosh was hurting. And so a lot of the times Tosh was just kind of going internal. I think I had mentioned on two separate occasions I can think of specifically, was like, hey guys, I just need to turn my mind off for a minute and just zone out. And you guys are like, okay, hey, cool. And then you picked up either the conversation or wasn't expecting me to be part of the conversation, and I could just sort of ride, you know, your wake, so to speak. And when Terry just started trotting, you know, the first thing that came to my mind was like, oh, fuck, man, here we go again. But I would shut that off and just be like, hey, just all you have to do is just do what the person in front of you is doing. And I would just start running. And it took a lot of pressure off of me as I sorted through a couple of those spots. So, you know, I appreciate that. But you guys were amazing, man. Tosh was hurting.
Hey, Terry and Tosh, this was your first time on the Western States course, right?
Correct.
Yep.
So I'd love to hear what you thought of it. Like what was your favorite part? What were there some parts where like, oh man, now I get what all the hype's about, or maybe the opposite, like this doesn't seem like such a big deal. Like first time ever on the Western States course and you're doing the whole freaking thing. You know, what was your impression of the course?
Go ahead, Terry.
Yeah, Terry.
Well, I was surprised by the technicality of a lot of the trails, a lot steeper and more rocky and technical than I was expecting. I know everyone, one of the things I had heard coming into it was about the canyons. So in my mind, there was this like one section of canyons throughout the course where it was like all like the first half, and then it kind of flattens out or it's more gradual. But I know, Don, you even mentioned a couple of times like, oh, we're out of the canyons. And then for the next 18 hours, we were still going through canyons. So it was kind of confusing. But overall, it was amazing. Of course, absolutely beautiful out there. And anytime you can be out in the mountains for that amount of time, it can't get much better than that.
Yeah, you know, the course is a bit more technical than you give it credit for. There's a lot of slippery rock. There's a lot of, you really have to be aware. You can't shut your mind off and just kind of cruise through. You always have to be present on that course, I think. So, Tosh, what was your thoughts? Great question, Andy.
Yeah, what an amazing course. You know, I knew going in that I was underestimating it. I had already set that for myself. Like, okay, hey, you're underestimating it. You're not respecting it. But I hadn't looked at an elevation profile or studied any of the legs or anything. And wow, you know, some steep ups and some steep downs, a lot of rocky terrain, you know, pretty technical in terms of, hey, foot placement and watch. And you could really bite you if you weren't paying attention, which is emotionally, mentally draining. So I really, really enjoyed it. And then going back afterwards and looking at the elevation profile, it's like, oh, that spot right there, I remember that one. I remember that one all too well, you know. But, you know, my favorite part was some of those long switchbacks on the way down.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
It really was fun. You know, the terrain got a little softer, less rocky, and we were able to trot it out. And it was, man, when was that? It was well into the 20-hour mark, yep, probably, for us or something.
Well, who knows what season or month we were in at that point of the race. But I think it was AJW, I think it was from mile 62, the Cow Loop, going down to the river. You know, that spot where they say, survive the canyons and then just take the trip down to the river and get yourself well, because there's a little bit of shade, there's some streams that run through, and it just gives you a chance to get your body back. Why don't you talk about that, AJW, just because I know you love the course so much, so maybe hearing from you and telling about that will be reminiscent for these guys.
Well, yeah. And following along, you know, with the text with Scotty and the crew, you all were at the Cal Street section, just a beautiful time of the day. And I'd love to talk about, by the way, how the river crossing went as well, because that was something I was, you know, that's always the big kind of question when you're doing Western States, not on a race day. How are you going to get across the river? But, you know, that single track section, it's sweeping. The technical part is a little bit past you at that point. You've been out now 62 miles. You can get up a little bit of momentum through there, and yet it's not entirely flat. You know, there's places where you're like, wait a minute, I thought we're just supposed to be all downhill to the river, and then all of a sudden you hit some little kicker uphill section. So I was definitely channeling you guys through that part, because that was cool. And I also knew from your crew that there were some really good food waiting for you at the river crossing. you guys ate pretty well on this trip too, didn't you?
Oh, well, 30 to 40 minute aid station stops were pretty typical.
Well, that's, I want to talk about that. I mean, this was an adventure. There was no time clock that was ticking. You spent a lot more time at aid stations. It wasn't planning to get in and out of an aid station as you're approaching the aid station. You got in there, you had a seat, you took care of everything that needed taken care of, and got a good meal, got everything you needed. How was that different than a race?
Well, it was very much 200 distance running style, where you drop down into a chair and somebody says, hey, what do you need? And you kind of put your hand up and you say, I'll tell you in a bit. I'm just going to sit here for a little while before I decide what I need. So it's much different. You guys go ahead and comment on that. On your aid stations, Terry?
Yeah, I think that was part of the strategy going into it, is we're going to look at this as a 200 miler. We're going to take care of ourselves at least through the first day, through the heat of the day, just make sure that we're feeling good. And I think part of that was taking our time at the aid stations, making sure we're drinking plenty of fluids, eating good food, and cooling off. And if that added time to our overall time, then so be it. We weren't concerned about that.
Yeah, and I think it also allowed us to really enjoy the course, enjoy each other's company, and enjoy the camaraderie and the spirit of all the support crew. You know, we were talking, how sucky would that be, Scott, when we got up to the top of Devil's 15 Thumbs or whatever that thing was, and we just blew in and blew out. You know, after you had set up, you took the time to drive there, remote location, and set up table with a beautiful spread, and hey, we roll in and we grab a Twix bar and a drink of water, and then we leave in 5 minutes. Just really, we would have lost something there in terms of that communal spirit, which I think was the highlight for me, was that with everybody.
I'm surprised that you spent as much time with me at Devil's Thumb, because just a short, 2 miles down the road at Deadwood Cemetery, which is a nice, flat, pretty, really runnable section, 2 miles later, you guys had steak and eggs. All I was offering was like potato chips and some Oreos.
Some soup. You had soup.
I had some soup. You guys downed the soup. I was not. Well, first of all, this is kind of a funny joke, a funny anecdote. I got there, I spent, I think about 6 or 7 hours at Devil's Thumb.
We like you there early. And it gave you time to organize all the chips because they were in alphabetical order.
And I was all prepared for these guys to be coming up the thumb in the heat of the day. So I had my Yeti cooler just soaking with ice water with towels, because I thought, what a better thing for them to have when they get up this hard climb out of these hot canyons, to put these nice ice cold towels around their neck and wipe their faces off. Well, Don came up and he's freezing. He is shivering. And I'm thinking, by the way, in my aid station kit, I have 2 cans of chicken noodle soup. I'm thinking, what do I have soup for? They're not going to want soup. Guess what? They needed the soup. They didn't need my ice towels.
It was my lowest point climbing up that hill. And I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, AJ, but I think there's 36 switchbacks coming up Thumb, right?
36, yeah.
Well, and they were joking about that. Weren't you, Tosh?
Yeah, tell the story, Tosh.
Freaking Freeman.
Tell how we got up
there. Don Bumscoop Freeman, who knows the course and is telling us every 2 miles, like, exactly what we're going to face for the next 5 miles, and was about 40. You know, weathermen are usually more accurate predicting weather patterns than Don. But you know, we hit these switchbacks, and it was like, man, this is supposed to be this massive, grueling climb. Let's do something to take our mind off of. So we just started counting the switchbacks in German, French, and Spanish.
Right.
So we would number, and we would just count the switchbacks. And there was only 28.
Well, we started a little late. And then it became what defines a switchback. And maybe, AJW, maybe you can clarify what is a switchback, because I missed a couple, and then they would harass me. And believe me, guys, I got more harassment. My pack... The harassment they were piling on was heavier than my pack. And so, was that a switchback, Don? I think I would have counted that one. Or you called that a switchback. So I got to 28. We need clarification what exactly a switchback is. But I would count it. I'd say eins, and they would say once and uno. And we just go on up, and we just exchange different languages going up. And it really did take our mind off it. What is a switchback, AJW? How do you define a switchback?
Oh, I have no idea, but I do know that Californians define them differently than Coloradans, who define them differently than East Coasters. I will say, though, that I've never counted them. I think it's just legend that there's 36 of them. It's kind of also legend that the course is 100 miles too, right? So,
I think it's 140 miles.
You know, I suppose it's, you know, you it's the switchback of the mind, right?
Yeah. Good answer. Let's talk about podium finish, guy. Oh, I do want to say this about my lowest point was coming up Devil's Thumb. I mean, the lowest point for the race for me. And there's a nice flat log to sit on, and I sat on it, and they let me, because the slowest guy is the pace setter, and my pace was sitting on a log, and so they sat next to me. And I was getting chilly, and I looked like I was just hit by a fire hose. I mean, I was just soaked coming up, and I don't know where all this fluid was coming from. And I was cold when I got to the top. And I said, Scott, do you have anything dry? You know, I'll wear it. Do you have anything dry? And to Scott's credit, because to know Scott is to know a saint, he pulled off his shirt and he said, here you go, pal. You can have my shirt. And, you know, the shirt off his back, the old story is really true. He would have offered just about anything there. And I talked him out of a jacket that he had underneath the seat. And then I got in his truck and curled up in a position that allowed me to feel like I was warm. And boy, it was good rest.
He got in the passenger seat of my truck. And I go, Don, what are you doing in there? There's a nice soft seat out here. He goes, I'm freezing. It's warmer in the truck.
I don't think it was that hot, that cold out. I was just cold. I wasn't doing well. But because of the proximity of the two aid stations, I was able to put myself together. Because of the group that I was with, that we go when you're ready type of attitude, it really made it great, which brings up the segue for podium finish. Tosh, what's a podium finish for our group?
Oh, well, we made it to the finish line. That's what we said. We're going to stand on a podium all together or none at all. You know, and when we arrive, we arrive. And it just so happened to be that there was three spots on the podium, and we filled all three, you know, just took it at our pace. But what we wanted to make sure was we weren't making decisions that would take the group out of the opportunity to stand on that podium together. And we were making those decisions ahead of time for the benefit of the group, whether it was regulating pace or managing food and rest or whatever that case was. And I think that's a great sense of accomplishment for the three of us. As I look at it as a team, it's like, yeah, hey, there we are, you know, and no worse off for wear either, right? Like, get to the podium with, you know, with massive injuries and a long rehab or recoup in front of you. We didn't really face that, you know. I think we all took a day to recover, and from the sounds of it, everybody's back on our feet and operating full 100%, you know, a day after we finished the race. So,
hey, I know the answer to this question, but I'll ask it for the audience. Did you ever get on each other's nerves? Was there a point that you wanted to push Don off the ledge?
Well, I did fall off once.
maybe you were pushed.
I was in the end of the line, though.
Okay. I mean, that's a long time to be spending with somebody, and you're giving it all mentally and physically and emotionally. Did emotions ever run thin?
Terry?
That was one of the surprising things for me, is that I can't remember a single time where any of us seemed to get on each other's nerves. Maybe we did, but we just didn't let it show, or we didn't say anything. But surprisingly, we all kind of made it work. I think all of our personalities matched together pretty well. We all seemed to keep our own egos in check. And if somebody wanted to slow down or something like that, nobody gave each other grief about it. I think it certainly helped too, playing little different mind games, like Tosh playing his 3-2-1 or 1-2-3 game, just little things like that, or having other people run with us for a little while. I know Scott was able to join us for some miles, Bo joined us for some miles, Emily joined us, and a few people at the end
leg. Nick came in and did Cal Street, that Cal Loop with us, and a great friend of Tosh's that we got to know, and we'll get to know more. So, great guy. Yep.
What is the 1-2-3 game, Tosh?
Oh, I don't know. I can't remember. you know, you want to know the 1-2-3 game, you got to join me for an adventure, or join Don and Terry for an adventure and learn from that. We're not going to share all of our trail secrets with you. If you want to know some of the secrets, you got to be on the course.
Oh,
you know?
Oh, I like that.
But, you know, I didn't find myself short-fused at all. I get upset with Terry when he looked so strong and would want to run. And I got pissed at Terry when he said, "Hey, Tosh, so Terry goes, "Tosh, so running's totally out of the question for you right now. And we've only got like 30 miles to go." And I'm just like, maybe 20. And I'm like, I know what he's doing right now. No, running's not out of the question. Let's go. Let's run and we'll see how it works out. And he's like, "Okay, you sure?" I'm like, "Yeah, I'll have to be, you know." But all in good jest, you know what I mean? All in good jest. I think had we have been pushing ourselves to the physical limits, our propensity to reach our emotional tolerances and limits for each other probably would have been more aggravated, right? Like, because we weren't really going to the depths of our well and then having to push a little bit more. And again, that wasn't the intent for the race or for the event, the adventure. But I feel like if we were really pushing hard, it would have made us a little bit more predisposed to be grumpy or intolerant, and obviously open the door for other frustrations. So I'm really, really glad that we chose this format for the adventure that we did. I think that's going to lead to Don in a point that he's going to wrap up with later down the road. But
I'd like to ask related to that, because we talked a little bit earlier about knowledge of the course. You guys, Terry and Tosh, you did put a fair bit of trust in Don because he's familiar with the course. Didn't necessarily put him in a leadership role, right? But you had to depend on him for route finding. If there are places, it's kind of tricky. Don, first, were there any places where you got a little off course, or you were out there a long time? Were there times where it was like, geez, I'm not sure if we go right or left here, or was your course route finding pretty dialed in all the way through?
Yeah, let me answer that before they answer. Okay.
Well, that's why I asked you first.
and AJW, your role, because you had a slot in this group, although that would have destroyed our podium finish.
Yeah.
But you had a slot in this, and you were going to be the trail guide. You were going to tell
historian
about the course, about this year and what Ann did on a certain year, and Tim's race when they were chasing each other. You're going to give us
did I mention the year I ran it in 2005?
2005. We would all know about 2005. And so if Scott didn't make it, I'd have my Cougar. And so we had the Gaia app, which is great, which is one of the reasons, as I encourage others to do this, or we encourage others, not just me, that the Gaia app allows you to load your favorite course and to execute with confidence. You can dial in exactly where you're at and see before it gets too late of making a wrong turn or wrong direction. And they've done such a good job. And so to go out there and experiment on a trail that you know, on a route that you know, and learn to have trust in it. We used it at all of Candace's 200s, and much of that you can't mark completely 200 miles. And like you said, AJW, there are a lot of whys and turns and rights and lefts that you can take, and many of the times that I've been able to be on that course, it was either dark or I was tired and I forget. So I had to rely quite a bit on that app and rely on Tosh being a navigator, and he's very good at that. So many times I just said, I think I need you to see this, Tosh. and that was his role. And I bypassed Terry on that, and I talked to him later about it. I said, I hope you weren't insulted that I would walk past you to get to Tosh to look at the map. But you know, Tosh was a map guy. And so that gave me a great bit of confidence when I needed some help.
Hey Terry, I have a question for you. Were you surprised at all that Don did not get you lost?
Oh, I got him lost.
I know I was surprised. Because they had GPS locators on them, so we were kind of following them. And I was surprised they stayed on course. I was thinking, you know, Don is an executor, but he's not a good planner.
Right.
And I was thinking, he's lucky that he got the course actually downloaded onto the Gaia app. But it seemed like that you guys were on course the most of the time.
Yeah, I was pretty confident in Don's abilities, so especially having Tosh there. I wasn't too concerned about anything going too wrong. There was a couple times where we may have got a little bit off course or something, but we figured it out and made our way back to it.
We only booty crashed once, but here's where they were most impressed with AGW. They were most impressed with my ability to forecast the profile coming ahead, right?
Those rollers. Those rollers.
A nice rolling section that consisted of a steep uphill climb, and then that's about it.
I told them with fresh legs that would have been a roller for them.
You know, I ran with them for the last section, and they were still hammering Don because of that. They're going. Don said, "And we have a short uphill,
a quarter mile uphill
right now." And Tosh would go, "Yeah, that's going to be another 4 miles of uphill climbing."
Hey, you know, before you come in AJW, before you come into 49, there's that you come off the quarry road and you have that climb kind of up that creek, right? You know what I'm talking about. I told them it was a quarter mile climb. Well, it's about 4 quarter mile climbs. They'd call back and look at back at me, and I'm about a quarter mile back halfway through the climb, and they would ask, "Hey, when is this quarter mile up?" Okay, now here, before we close, one thing that I want to go over right now, and I'd like to at this point set it forward. We tested it on the trail. We talked about it. We have really massaged this methodology and level of communication to the point, at least we were convinced, that it was accurate and that it works. And that is estimating your, Tosh is already laughing, your level of fatigue, right? How do you classify a problem? And so we made three categories. Category one, you have a problem and you're the only one that can see it. So you may, let's just take a foot for an example. You pull in and you go, "Yeah, I've got a hot spot. It really hurts right here." You take off your shoe and your sock and everybody's looking for it. Nobody can find it, you know, but it bothers you. That's a level one. Level two, someone can see it and it corresponds with the spot that you feel it. Level two and level three, you need to see a doctor immediately. Okay. These are the three categories, and under each one of those categories is a 0 to 10 scale. How much does it bother you? I have a level one. I'm the only one that can see the problem and is bothering me at a level 5 or a 7 or an 8. So it becomes like, I know it's very complicated. People can rewind it and listen to it. It took us nearly 100 miles to dial this in. And to me, it's so very clear that, you know, level 1, you're the only one who can see the problem. Level 2, people that necessarily with an untrained eye, somebody qualified to work in an aid station could identify the area and see the problem. And then 3, we need to get helicoptered out of here. You've got a big problem. What do you think, AGW?
I think it's clear to the listeners now why this run took you guys so damn long. I mean, if you had to listen to Don's 3-point scale, 10-point scale for 39 hours, oh my God, you guys deserve a medal.
We broke 40.
well, it didn't take him that long. I mean, he was able to present his strategy and then refine it himself, and it was about 6 hours long, and it it took us about 5 miles. So it passed 5 miles, 6 hours of time, which was really good. And then, you know, we kept dialing it in. And I'm pretty happy with it, Don. I think you should trademark it.
You supported it out there. You thought it was good, Tosh. Now you're kind of pushing back a little bit.
No, I'm a fan. I tried to explain it to Scott, and he poo-pooed it.
Well, I will tell you that now that it's been explained with English, it actually makes a little more sense. When they came up the thumb and Don is hurting, he goes, guys, I'm a 1-8. I'm a 1-8, man. I'm a 1-9. I got to sit down. And I'm going, what's this? And so they try to explain it to me, and it took them a while. And at the end, I'm more confused than I was when they started. But what I did know is the scale started coming down as Don was recovering. He goes, okay, guys, I'm a 1-6. I'm 1-6. I'm coming down.
At 1-4, I was ready to launch off. Yeah. But remember, Tosh was speaking in French. Yeah. And Terry in Spanish. So no wonder you couldn't understand it.
Yeah, I didn't understand it at all. Now I'm thinking that it could be a viable theory.
So
if not anything, for any other reason than just for yourself, to have something that you can use as a rubric to forecast something before it becomes a problem, and you can start problem solving in anticipation. You know, oh wow, man, this little hot spot in my foot's a 1-4. Well, it's going to be a 1-7 in another 10 miles if I don't just take 30 seconds and fish this rock out, you know, and hey guys, I got to fish a rock out of my shoe. Okay, cool. I'm going to take a piss while you do that. Okay. Hey, fine. I'm going to check the map while you guys are doing that. And then you can kind of, you know, coordinate efforts. And then, hey, Don gets the rock out of his shoe. He's like, oh, that's so much better. If I would have let that go, that could have been a 2-1. And then I would have had to get some blister care at the aid station, and it would have taken me 60 minutes and a couple more cupcakes in order to get back down to where I can run again. And so at least it was a cool system that we could use to communicate to each other. And then also solve problems, you know, problem solve in advance and in anticipation.
There's no doubt a 1-7 will turn into a 2-7 if you don't take care of business. And I think that's, AJW, I'll pitch that over to you. That's the secret of ultra running. Not that these guys don't know, because they're veterans and they do things. But you're the fresh voice on this one, that ultra running is about solving problems. And it's about identifying them early and making corrections.
Well, and you guys are all 200 mile veterans as well. I'm not that. But, you know, certainly when you get into that territory, you know, in the, you know, 2, 3, 4 days out there, you know, the problem solving skills that are necessary, coupled with sleep deprivation or any other things that might happen to you out there, you know, are become exponentially more difficult. So, I mean, all joking aside, having a system like that where you can have a common shared language with the crew you're running with the crew who's taking care of you, could certainly help. And I think it does make sense to have a common language, but also something that then you have experiences with certain things. So, okay, this is what a 1-7 is, and I'm not going to be able to get out of here until I'm down to a 1-3. That's very, very valuable.
Hey, there was, I think it may have been you, Tosh, in a previous podcast, and I want to ask the group about this. The whole idea of keeping up versus catching up in this group dynamic. Terry, did you, I would assume that since you're the young gun, you were out front, did you find that it was easier for your teammates to keep up, or did they slack behind and then have to pull double time to get caught up?
No, I think for the most part, everyone did a pretty good job keeping up.
Okay.
Because I think we all knew that it would be harder to catch up. And I also think as a whole, our team did a good job of making sure that people didn't fall behind, so that they then would have to catch up. So I think we were all pretty aware of that. And I think Tosh mentioned that a couple of times out there. And so we all had that in mind.
Yeah, it's easier.
Yeah, I think it was good. Sorry, Don. You know, when there's three people and you're trying to stay together, we all have different gaits and we all have different strengths, either on the uphill or the downhill or the flats. And we're all going to go through different phases of our moods and prowess or whatnot. And so, you know, it was, I think, keeping up instead of catching up on a step for step thing is less less the significance in this case, right? Like I like to go behind, you know, the dust is kicking up and I'd like to be 20 meters behind the rest of the group. And it wasn't because I couldn't be foot for foot with them. And I knew that I could open my stride up to where it was my comfortable stride and I would be right there on their foot if I needed to be. Or if Don had to take a piss, you know, Terry and I would just walk and then Don would catch up with a stride there. So there wasn't really any excessive expenditure for the catch up piece in the physical sense. But where I was going with it in my mind was I felt my body starting to lag or my mood or something. It's like, okay, hey, cool. I need to do something now in order to catch up or to keep up. I'm sorry, to keep up with Don and keep up with Terry where they're at in their hydration or their mood or their strategy or something like that. So I was always thinking along those lines of, hey, keep up with Don and Terry in the emotional, spiritual sort of sense, and some of the physiological things outside of just stride or pace and proximity. And that drove me to make different decisions at checkpoints than I might have normally made had I been out there by myself. You know, okay, hey, when I get to this checkpoint, I need to do this and this this time because that's going to allow me to keep up with Terry and Don, who I'm perceiving them at a certain level, you know, and I think we all did really, really good job of that, you know, and there was a lot of trust between the three of us and an implicitness of camaraderie as well that allowed us to use this setting to do those things, which again, I just found really, really exciting, you know. Anyways.
Yeah, I think that really sets the stage for inviting others to do something similar, you know, to put together, to bring a core group, people that you trust, and a course that you wish that you could get into in a lottery, or one that you just wish that you could run, but it doesn't fit your schedule, of going out and doing it, empowering yourself and trusting yourself and building a team and handling logistics and then making them available for others and sharing them and, you know, sharing a Gaia file that you might have or bringing access to others. I just think this is, you know, COVID has changed a lot of things. And I think it's also changed the dynamics of this adventure of bringing your friends together, not missing, but creating. And I really enjoyed it. And I wish you were there too, AJW.
Well, I want to say something related to that, Don, and thank you. I'm bummed I wasn't, but you know, one of the challenges for those of us who've been around Western states for, you know, the last couple of decades has been dealing with this year's cancellation and kind of the feeling of an absence in our lives. And I know that, you know, people deal with that sort of thing differently, but a lot of Western states veterans, we've talked over the years about honoring the bib. When you get that bib, you know, you get the privilege of getting it in the lottery or getting in for some special way, like a top 10 finish or a golden ticket. You want to honor the bib. And hearing you guys talk, even though you didn't literally have bibs, you really did honor the bib. You honored the bib because you were in it as a group of three, along with your support crew. You were in it for the long haul right from the get-go. You know, you were going to be doing it together. You were going to be working together. You were going to take your time. You were going to gauge your effort. And you were respectful. And I think you gave the course the credit it deserves. It's not the hardest 100-mile course in the world. It's not anything close to that. But you gave it the credit it deserved. And in so doing, in a year when no one was able to honor the bib, you guys did that. And I think maybe that can be inspiration to others who may want to run the Western States course as a do-it-yourself run in the future. It's doable. There's a lot of logistics you guys had to work through, but you did it and you honored the bib. And that, as a Western States veteran, that makes me feel really good. So thanks for doing that.
Hey, I want to throw in just on that topic, Andy. While I was sitting at Devil's Thumb for the 6 hours, I'm sitting there just kind of enjoying it, and all of a sudden I hear this, sir, sir. And I met Eric Spector and his wife, and I forgot her name. I apologize if you're listening.
Mrs. Spector.
Eric Spector is, I believe, 74 years old, and he actually got in to Western States with one of Hoka, who's one of the sponsors for Western States. They gave him one of their entries, and here is a guy that 11 months from now, he may be running Western States in 2021, and he's taking the bib seriously. He was out there on the course with his wife, and he's called me since because we exchanged phone numbers. He was out there with his wife. She was running the car from point to point, and he was running by himself at 74 years old, running the canyons, those hard, hard canyons, so that he could prepare himself 11 months prior to the race. He was taking it, or is taking it, very seriously, and I look forward to following him next year.
Fantastic. Well, I guess next up is figuring out which adventure we need to tackle
hey,
next,
before that, I do want to ask about a couple pieces of equipment. One is the Hoka 10-9. We were fortunate enough to get, some people were fortunate enough to get a pair of these 10-9s. If you haven't seen them, Google Hoka 10-9. They're the most obscene piece of running shoe you've ever seen in your life that I believe in because I've run in them and I love them. Terry and Tosh were able to run in these shoes for a little bit of the course. Don, unfortunately, because he has monster feet, his didn't come in time. But I want to get your opinion on the shoe.
Yeah, I think man. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was pleasantly surprised with them. I wore them for all but, I think, 6 miles of the course. Obviously, the shoes look a little different, but when you're wearing them, they feel like any other shoe. If anything, they feel very stable. They have a very wide footprint, which certainly came in handy on some of that loose, rocky terrain on some of the downhills. I think if we want to run a fast course, or if you're running on a little shorter race and wanted to let go on the downhills, you certainly can in these shoes, and I think that helps. I have nothing but good things to say about them.
Yeah, Terry, you actually took them off at like mile 40 or something and then switched to your old trusties, but then put them back on 6 miles after when we hit that short aid station stop, and you put them right back on. I was like, whoa, did you just put them back on? And you're like, yeah, I really like these. I was just curious if you had experience in Hokas before.
I actually bought a pair about a month before the trip. I bought a pair. I wore them on two runs. And I ended up taking them back. I didn't like them. I didn't like the toe box. It seemed a little bit too narrow for me from what I'm used to. But with the 10-9s, the toe box was very wide. It was very similar to the shoes I'm used to wearing. So I think that went a long ways, especially in a distance like 100 miler or even for a 200 miler.
Tosh, what was your experience?
Yeah, I put them on for the first time for the first 30 miles, and
why
I enjoyed
not?
Them. You know, they weren't bad. They're, you know, that you look at them and they're like giant Bigfoot shoes, and you feel like you're gonna be awkward. And I walked around in the house with them for a couple hours, and I was like, man, these are awkward. But I'll put them on when it comes time to run in them, and we'll see if I can adjust. And I did. I enjoyed them. The toe box felt, the shoe overall felt a little bit roomier than I had experienced Hokas in the past. You know, I usually run in the Altras, and because I like that big roomy toe box. And but these, they felt wider and more roomier than the average Hokas. I've been running Hokas for a while now, and I really like them also. So I took them off at the 30-mile mark to give a switch on my feet, and I put my other pair of Hokas back on, and I just stayed with those for the rest of the course just because they were, you know, they were broken and coming. I didn't feel like swapping back over again. I just did it that way, but they're interesting, you know.
How about you, AJW? Have you run in the 10-9s before?
Yeah, I tell you what, man, floating the downhills. You can just float the downhills. But I agree with Tosh. They take a little getting used to because they're so big. I mean, they really take you back to the really, really early 2010, 2011, you know, Hokas, the real clown shoes. They're not quite like that, but man, for downhills, they are just like running on clouds. Amazing.
Now, another takeaway was Path Projects, Terry, who typically that I've seen run, and I've run a few races with him, he gets chafage so bad between his thighs, he's like he's on an invisible horse when you see him. He's just, his legs are far apart, and he motates down the trail. And he put on the new a new pair of liners and a new pair of shorts. Terry, give us a report on that, because I think this is a good takeaway for people.
Yeah, it's probably the first time I've run a distance even close to this without any chafing. I applied some squirrel's nut butter at the beginning and then about the 50-mile mark, but there was not a single time where I even felt on the verge of getting chafing. I think that's all has to be due to the Path Project shorts and the liners. I've been wearing them consistently since then, and haven't.
You've
haven't
washed
had
them,
any
haven't
issues.
You? You've washed them, right?
maybe once.
All right, guys, I can't thank you enough for joining and trusting me to go on this thing and saying yes before I even knew what the challenge was. And so I appreciate you committing and coming and taking the time out, taking the effort out. It means a lot to me. And I made the right choices. You guys are inspiring to me. And I knew that I needed something to pull me through, and you were my pull-throughs. And so thank you, guys.
No, thank you, Don. Oh. Hey, I'd like to throw it out there. Next year, let's do it again. Let's go Auburn to Squaw back to Auburn and invite a bigger crowd. And if you bigger crowd wants to do 100, they can pick which direction they want to do the 100 in, and the three of us to do the 200. And obviously AJW just invited himself in to do the 200 since he's never 200 before. And if we get ahead of it in the calendar, instead of just 6 weeks, 8 weeks out,
a little planning,
spectacular event.
All right. Well, good thing I'm editing this podcast, AJW.
Oh, I couldn't think of a better place to do my first 200 than twice on the Western States course, right? What could go wrong?
Nothing. All right. So until
I do want to put a plug in for Michelle. If any of you guys are trying to chart out your next adventure and you need somebody to organize your race, get in touch with Don, because Michelle, who is a rookie to these ultra distances, she was one of the most extraordinary race directors. It's crazy how well she did on this.
Well,
thing.
She's organized and she's a veteran now. So
she's for hire, I think. At least I'm telling you she is.
So go out and run.
Mas.